Hear Here, the Humanitarian Podcast, a podcast by Hear Geneva.
Founded in 2014, Hear Geneva turns 10 in November this year. The system and its internal dynamics have changed very little over the past decade. From the start, Hear focused on the discrepancy between policy and practice, building evidence and putting forward constructive analyses of where the gaps are and where gains can be made for governments and agencies to fulfill their humanitarian responsibilities and commitments. In the lead up to our anniversary, join us as we look back on previous work, highlighting the lessons and recommendations that past pieces have brought up, and exploring any outcomes, follow-up, or lack thereof. This episode is but one of many components of our retrospective. You can find the full series at here-geneva.org/hear10. My name is Valhan Bieber-Bruggen. Welcome to the podcast.
Today, I'm joined by Ed Schenkenberg, HEAR's Executive Director, and Marcia Montemuro, HEAR's Research Director. Ed, Marcia, thank you both very much for joining me today. HEAR was founded 10 years ago, and when it was founded, you chose the tagline, Bridging the Gap Between Policy and Humanitarian Practice. Do you see the same gap existing today as it did 10 years ago, or has this gap changed over the past decade?
Thanks, Val. I'll let Marcia, maybe her memory is better than mine, who came up with the tagline. I'm not exactly sure, but I think it's very apt. You know, even yesterday afternoon, there was a meeting, you know, of course, in a way, a closed door sort of not non-public meeting, but still, I think I should say something about it, because this was a meeting of the global cluster coordinators. And I came in, and they were discussing an issue around the deactivation or the transition of the cluster. So, you know, after several years or after a certain time when a crisis is, a situation is becoming more stable, the clusters would sort of phase out. Well, it was kind of a surprise on my part that they were discussing this. And then I heard, in fact, them say, yeah, we've been discussing this for 2.5 years. And I was thinking to myself, 2.5 years? In fact, this was a question when we started, when the clusters were started in 2005 and 6. So apparently, so many years later, you know, there are still policy gaps. I mean, this is a policy gap, perhaps. But interestingly, and that was the other issue that came up in the discussion, was the question around designation of cluster leadership, which has been brought up by the independent review of the humanitarian response to IDPs, which has just come out. And also, in fact, is an issue in the evaluation that will be released soon on the interagency humanitarian response to Tigray, where certain agencies may not have been in the position. I mean, they were not in the position to deliver. They did not have the capacity. They were hardly present. And for that reason, they should not have been cluster leads. This is in policy around the clusters. Again, it goes back to 2005 and 6. And they were discussing it as if this was a new thing. You know, that there needs to be clear designation and that there needs to be clarity on who is the cluster lead agency. Again, so, you know, there is policy on this. This is not a gap at all. The gap is in the implementation, or apparently people not knowing even that that policy exists.
Indeed, and I think one of the things that we thought at the time when we came up with the tagline was also the idea that we were looking at policy more generally. So the understanding that there was a lack of communication between what people were doing in programs, in operations, in countries where there were there's humanitarian responses happening, and then the conversations that were happening at the Geneva or New York level. And that's also where we realized that actually the tagline that we wanted was to focus on policy, because we were also looking at some of the policies coming out of UN Security Council, so not necessarily just within the confines of the traditional humanitarian system and humanitarian practice. So really acknowledging the, if you want, the careful balance that exists between policy and politics and how that affects humanitarian practice. And I think that you can see all the more today. You can mention so many different examples, but I think the latest, looking at what is happening in Gaza and the most recent UN Security Council resolution calling for ceasefire and how much we've gotten there, and the whole dilemmas in terms of, you know, when it comes to humanitarian practice as for organizations, humanitarian actors, what to do, when to call for a ceasefire. Is it a ceasefire? Is it about humanitarian access, humanitarian corridors? So I think that for me is also the reason why that gap still exists and the tagline is still valid. There's still an importance and urgency to continue focusing on that.
And so if HEAR were to be founded in 2024 instead of 2014, would you make any adjustments at all to the tagline, or do you still see it as being completely relevant in the same way that it was a decade ago?
Well, I think the examples, Val, that we have just mentioned, mine specific to the humanitarian system, Marzia is a bit more bigger picture. They're still very relevant. And in fact, yeah, what we all know, of course, the world hasn't become, unfortunately, a better place in recent times. Quite the opposite. So, you know, and particularly, of course, the issue around the implementation or the lack of implementation and the lack, therefore, of respect, the disrespect for international humanitarian law, for instance, that we see in a number of conflicts, in a very stark manner. It only points to the relevance, and even more so, I think, it's very, very relevant still today, this gap.
Why do you think the gap is still there?
My view, both actually in the global picture. I mean, the Security Council example that Marzia just mentioned, and at a different level, the fact that apparently there are humanitarian organizations, that agencies in the UN that become cluster leads that actually do not have the capacity to lead. Those were the two examples. The fact that that happens, I think there's only one reason for it. There's no accountability. I mean, you know, there are no implications for Israel not following up from, you know, not adhering to the or not following, complying with the International Court of Justice, its provisional ruling, or at a very different level. But, you know, the mechanism is the same. There are no implications. There are no consequences for agencies that take on, you know, that say we are the cluster lead, but in fact do not lead. You know, so there's no risk for them in assuming that role or in continuing it, if you like, because nothing happens if they fail to deliver.
And I think the other thing for me, and you can see it in the focus we've had for the past 10 years, in narrowing the gap to three specific areas. So accountability being definitely one of them. And you can see it both in terms of, as Ed was saying, at the more general level, the, you know, abiding by the law, but also more in terms of internally within the humanitarian system, you know, who is held accountable for what? How do you make sure that those policies are translated? And I'm thinking around, specifically, for example, very much needed policies like centrality of protection, some of these more specific elements that are needed in humanitarian response. And again, I think accountability is really there, but for us, it's also been identifying the gap when it comes to specifically protection. So I was referring to indeed the centrality of protection and the need for it, and humanitarian principles. In a way, you know, what the if you want, the basis or the core framework for any humanitarian response. And you may see that there's an evolution in terms of how these are being discussed over time, but they're still very much there. And I think, there may be different understandings of how one may interpret the application of the principles, or, you know, how do you actually translate disenchantment protection in practice? What does accountability mean at an individual and collective level? But at the same time, we believe that those three areas are really fundamentally the issues that shape that specific gap. And in that sense, I don't think we would change that much either.
Why those three? You said, you mentioned accountability, protection, and principles. Why are those the three that were picked out as HEAR's main areas of interest?
It's because that's where we saw the biggest gap was when we look at situation of armed conflict. So we made a specific choice to focus on responses, humanitarian responses in situations of armed conflict. It's not because we don't believe that humanitarian responses and man-made or natural disaster situations is less important or less urgent. We just realized that there were several issues where there hadn't been a lot of progress yet, and where, again, it was easier to look at some technical fixes, check the box exercise, you know, in terms of applying some policies at the very practical level, but you still didn't tackle some of the major issues. And, you know, these were those, you know, protection. We haven't really made much progress. And I think some of the reviews, also more recent, have pointed to that. You know, the fact that we're still trying to decide what protection means, and we don't have a same common definition of what protection is, that's concerning. But I think it's pointing to the fact that it's still valid to look at it. And then the question of accountability, as Ed was saying, it's permeating the whole reason as to why there is still a gap between policy and practice. And then finally, the humanitarian principles have been and still are, in a way, the guiding light. The question is indeed how everybody interprets and applies them, but that's the starting point for any response. And so we thought that if we focus on those, that's really, if you want, setting the basis for our ability to then to start pinpointing both the, you know, the nuances and the gaps, and try to identify some of the solutions. So that's where those three came from.
So yeah, Marta, you mentioned just now, you mentioned the, you know, that you saw the potential to pinpoint certain issues in these three topics. Where do you see HEAR's added value in addressing the gap for all of these? And this question, I mean, I said, Marta, you just mentioned, but of course, Ed, please feel free to answer this as well.
I'll start, and then Ed, please definitely jump in. I think when you start looking at, you know, these three issues, I mentioned the fact that in a way there's still a lack of commonality of views are coming together. And I think the fact that we play that independent role is essential. So you need to have, if you want, independent watchdogs, independent analysts that have that umbrella view and that are able to see, if you want, the bigger picture outside the narrow view of, you know, a specific agency, a specific issue, or a certain mandate that may inform, you know, if you want, choices or a certain understanding. And so for me, our added value is indeed the idea that we are independent. And because we're independent, it's also the ability that we have to convene and be able to bring together this different perspectives so that there's an opportunity at better understanding how to best address the gap. Again, we've seen it through some of our work in Iraq, in Yemen, when we talk about principles. I think, you know, even if people know what the principle of humanity, impartiality, independence, and neutrality say, so what the definition is, in practice, we have seen concretely that they will actually interpret it really differently in terms of how they make decisions for the programming. But they don't have the ability or the honesty or the transparency to actually acknowledge such differences. And I think that's where we have the added value of being able to point and actually make these differences more transparent and more easily viewed.
Where I think we can, maybe we should do better, if you see what I mean, as HEAR. so one of the gaps, for instance, that we see particularly is also between, let's say, the working level. And I think Marzia indeed pointed to a number of issues, you know, that, of course, are very much sort of at the concern of the working level. But where we're also looking is particularly, of course, the strategic, the leadership level, the political level, if you like. And there's a gap between the two, so to speak. You know, to what degree do, I mean, they say they care. So, you know, whether that level is, let's say, the heads of agencies at the Inter-Agency Standing Committee or the heads of humanitarian departments in donor ministries or even their bosses, so to speak. So they say that, of course, they care about principled humanitarian approach, protection, so all the issues we have mentioned. But to what degree they have the time, or for that matter, the interest, to examine or to understand the degree to which their teams in their organization are actually are you know, following up on those commitments, are implementing them, I think is an issue. And to what degree, you know, do they want to see, are they really creating change in the organization? And vice versa, we also see a gap from the working level that, you know, they feel there's a certain obstacle, or there's, you know, that the leaders at the top, they're too busy. Well, and too busy then with what, if you see what I mean? I'm sure they have very busy agendas, but do they set their priorities in the right way? So the working level feels that, you know, so once they're producing messages and so on, and that's certainly what we have seen in our work, for them, I think it's a question, or there is an issue, to what degree, in fact, the leaders of their organizations are even interested or available in taking those messages forward, so to speak. So there's a real disconnect between the political or the leadership level and the working level. And our added value, I think, is also in addressing that gap. But what I said at the beginning, I think we could probably, or perhaps we should think about, you know, how could we even do a better job by connecting these two levels, if you see what I mean.
And just to kind of piggyback off of what you just said, you mentioned it as possibly being an issue of time and interest. Do you think that there's a skill set issue as well as that being the source of the disconnect?
Well, I mean, there may be skills issues around, you know, incompetence and so on, or not, you know, people not having sufficient skills. But the issue is exactly that, you know, and I think there we're back to the issue of accountability. You know, especially, for instance, I already mentioned the evaluation on the response to Tigray. We wanted to interview the leadership level, because we knew they were very active during the response at the political level. I also understand that, you know, humanitarian diplomacy, yeah, there is a certain level of discretion needed. You know, to some degree, perhaps there's some limits to a degree of transparency, if you see what I mean, because obviously we would push for transparency. But precisely the deals that they cut at that level, you know, why, for instance, did the EU not pursue the accountability of the government of Ethiopia, particularly in the human rights domain? You know, word has it that particularly it was the EU, so Ethiopia making efforts to make sure that the commission, the panel of experts investigating the human rights abuses during the war, would be discontinued. Initially, the EU was very much, you know, making efforts to ensure that that panel could continue. And then suddenly they dropped that. And yeah, then the rumor in the international domain was this was because, you know, migration issues. I mean, you know, obviously the EU making deals with certain countries in Africa around particularly migration and stopping refugees and asylum seekers from moving onward, so to speak. I don't know if that was the reason, but that, you know, I mean, that's exactly what happens then at the political level, where there's a complete lack of accountability around those deals. And I think, as speaking, you know, as the head of here, I think we need to perhaps focus from time to time a little bit more on that level. But it starts also with being able first actually to ask them, kind of these questions, if you see what I mean. And yeah, unfortunately, in the context of the evaluation of the response to Tigray, we were not able to do that.
We've spoken now about the gap that exists more between policy staff and operational staff, and, you know, the kind of decision-making level and the, let's say, the executing the decisions level. But some might also argue that the gap that we look at is more between humanitarian policy and development practice. I don't know if you can maybe react to this assessment of the work that we do.
Yeah, I think, you know, the whole question in terms of the linkages between humanitarian and development work, it's been there for ages. And I think there's definitely been a lot of progress when it comes to programming. There's organizations that were set up and seamlessly integrate transition from humanitarian to development work. I think the challenge in terms of connecting humanitarian policy with development practice is that there's actually very little dialogue to begin with between humanitarian policy and development policy to begin with. So the idea that there would be a gap between humanitarian policy and development practice is, of course, foregone. You know, when, for example, there was the whole negotiation around the sustainable development goals, there was a bit of an opportunity for humanitarian actors to integrate that conversation. And some of them did. And the challenge was to make sure that humanitarian action would not be, in a way, folded under development as, you know, the, in a way, the type of response that you need in order not to damage any development progress or achievements that you may have reached. And so I think if you start seeing it in that way, then humanitarian goals by themselves become secondary because they are really substituted within development goals. Now, because you don't have that dialogue between humanitarian policymakers and development policymakers necessarily, that also translates sometimes in difficulty in understanding sort of the specificities, but also the complementarities between humanitarian work and development work. It's absolutely necessary. We've seen it, you know, if you are working in protracted refugee crisis, humanitarian responses only bring you that far. What you need is to make sure that, you know, refugees can express and can fulfill their right to work, have an opportunity to be included into social protection systems. And that is something that development actors can definitely contribute towards. And, you know, they can make sure that refugees can be seen as an asset to the society that they've integrated. But it's not as easy as, you know, as you can conceptually think of it. And some of it is because of this lack of dialogue. Some of it is because you also have very different ways of working, which translates in a lack of alignment. And we go back to this lack of understanding in terms of how everybody works, which is also impacting in a way what we then feel is the gap between humanitarian policy and development practice.
I mean, there's one kind of bizarre thing which I think is often overlooked when we talk about humanitarian and development, and perhaps in a later stage as part of our, you know, 10 messages in light of our 10 years of here. I suppose then we'll talk particularly about the study that certainly Marcia led around what we call multi-mandate. I mean, many organizations are delivering humanitarian, are not just delivering humanitarian response, they're also development organizations. So the dialogue Marcia is talking about should also or particularly happen in those organizations between the humanitarian and development colleagues, you know. So maybe there's a gap there. And I, again, I think some of that we looked into as part of that that study that I think will highlight at a later stage. But, you know, I think in the sort of dialogue and, you know, the famous nexus, I think it's still overlooked that many of the same organizations are both humanitarian and development. As you know, they're two different worlds. Well, actually, you know, the people may be on different floors in an office building, but perhaps, you know, it starts there, exactly, having that dialogue.
Yeah, I I was going to pick up on this because, Ed, you mentioned Nexus for the first time at the tail end of this entire discussion. And I mean, between the moment when HERE was founded and today, there have been what we hoped would be watershed moments for the humanitarian sector. And I'm thinking of the World Humanitarian Summit, the Grand Bargain, Grand Bargain 2.0, Grand Bargain 3.0, the whole... So there have been attempts at developing tools to bridge this gap. And I'm curious to know what your thoughts are on either the instruments that I've mentioned or any other ones that you can think of as what do you think of them as instruments to address the gap?
So there's two things, Val. I think first, what you just pointed out, there's no lack of efforts and there are no lack of policies in that sense. And we already discussed they are not necessarily implemented or followed up on. And certainly there's no accountability when you don't implement them. That's one. Second, you know, the humanitarian community is very good at starting things like the Grand Bargain. And then, you know, in fact, they become sort of self-perpetuating, if you see what I mean. We don't stop them anymore, even when I think they have sort of reached their limits, at least to a certain degree, I would say. You know, and why I'm saying that is the Grand Bargain was very simple initially. The message around the Grand Bargain was there's inefficiencies in the sector. There was even the figure being attached to it of 1 billion. I don't think that was ever further researched or looked into, but leave that. I mean, certainly the issue was around inefficiencies, and so addressing efficiency as such. It became much more, it became a Christmas tree, you know, different things being put onto it, and it became much more around effectiveness or all sorts of different things. Whereas, in fact, there are other processes in the humanitarian sector, or there should be other processes around that because, you know, humanitarian principles are not necessarily mentioned in the Grand Bargain. Protection is not a focus in the Grand Bargain. And I'm not saying it should be. I'm saying we have other mechanisms or processes for that as such. And then recognize, you know, so Grand Bargain has achieved its aim. If we need further improvement in the sector, precisely around humanitarian principles of protection, let's make sure we focus on those, so to speak. You know, and what, in fact, what we see now is many of these discussions are also siloed, which also creates a problem that, you know, there's not sufficient conversation, as I said, and cross-fertilization among the various policy initiatives. So, you know, I'm afraid I'm not particularly mentioning or pointing to solutions here, other than to say, you know, actually, at some point, we should realize the policy exists. Let's now focus on implementation.
Marcia, would you like to add anything?
Yeah, I've been thinking, you know, because we've started focusing on our tagline, you know, the gap between policy and practice, I think we've been looking at it still from the gap side, so from the negative. And I think it's important to highlight the fact that there's been progress. So even if you look at the, you know, my personal opinion, if you look at the cluster response, I think the cluster response was necessary. It has achieved a certain level of predictability. Is it perfect? No, it's not perfect. I think, you know, the same with the Grand Bargain. It was necessary in a way of creating a platform where, in principle, different constituents of the humanitarian sector would be able to come together on an equal basis. Now, to what extent that has happened, has not happened, to what extent it still takes work, absolutely. I think it's nobody denies that, and that's why we go back to our first answer is to, yes, we believe the gap is still there. But I think it's also, I think, maybe important to acknowledge the fact that I think for change to happen, we need to realize that it's a bit of an iterative process. You kind of go two steps forward, one step backward. And I think it's also the question that we'll probably see later on is the fact that we don't seem to be able to really be good at learning our lessons. So, you know, we may do a lot of reviews, a lot of evaluations, a lot of studies, but then we kind of move on without necessarily building on what we've learned so far. And I think it's an important consideration to keep into account also when starting to think as to why do we still have this gap.
And is this we here, or is the we the humanitarian sector at large, or both?
So I see ourselves as an integral part of the humanitarian sector just because of the ambition that we have to contribute to making it better. So I think it's, you know, it's a self-reflection, but I think it's the fact that we are playing hopefully a role that is useful and helpful in supporting and guiding some of the broader conversations that are happening within the sector.
Yeah. And Ed, I just wanted to go back to something that you mentioned before. You said, you know, the policy is there, but it's the implementation that's lacking. And I think, you know, you could argue that with our tagline being what it is, there's this idea that it basically rests on the idea that policy is good. It's just the practice that isn't following. Is that a statement, that an assessment that you would agree with?
Not all the policies are perfect or, you know, are magic solutions, if you see what I mean. But, you know, not following sort of basic issues that, you know, we agreed on. I started off by, you know, pointing to the early days of the clusters when deactivation was an issue, maybe somewhat unresolved at the time or different opinions on it, but certainly was discussed. But then what were certainly clarity on was, as I said, you know, cluster leadership and how it should be, that there should be a clear designation by the humanitarian coordinator. And here we are, what is it, 18 years or, you know, 16 years later. And apparently there's no clarity on it and people don't even know what is in the policy. Maybe in that sense there are even too many policies now, if you see what I mean, that we have lost the forest because of the trees. Too many guidelines and you know, even questions around the basics of it, so to speak. But again, you know, policies, whatever you have, they're not, they don't do magic, but they give you an indication, a framework in terms of what a response or what an action should look like, so to speak. Yeah, and if that's not happening on the ground, of course, there's always sort of mitigating factors, external factors, so to speak, things that you cannot influence. But there are lots of things that we can influence and that we have control of, and in fact, that we even have agreed on, you know, to address in a certain way. And if that's not happening, it clearly points to a gap.
I think I want to stir the pot just a little bit further and ask you, because you mentioned policies as not being perfect, are there any areas in the system currently where you feel like the policies that exist are bad, or is it more that there are places where we need policies that don't exist yet?
No, I'm not sure policies are necessarily bad or whatever, but what we see, I mean, I just said something about too many policies, so again, based on the work that we have done recently, certainly in certain contexts that we see on the ground now and in an armed conflict, certainly where the you know, the central government is a party to the conflict, you know, not all policies are equally important. It relates to the context. And in such a context, when a government is party to a conflict, in non-international armed conflict, you know, issues such as humanitarian principles, humanitarian law, protection, they should come first. Whereas in fact now agencies seem to be forced to work off a template in which everything is as important. It's not. Sorry, you need to prioritize in such a situation. And the things that we particularly have mentioned that are foundational, I think, to humanitarian action, yeah, they should come first. So, you know, there are issues there. And that, again, Val, goes back to leadership that I think we addressed earlier.
Yeah, and I mean, I think with that, you could say that we've closed the loop, and because these have been issues that HEAR has been working on for the past decade, exactly. And we circle back to the three priorities of accountability, protection, and principles.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Are you happy to wrap it here? Is there anything that we didn't discuss?
No, I think we... Thank you.
Okay. Thank you both so much for joining and for sharing your thoughts and for, yeah, being so honest in terms of the perspectives that you've shared. I know that honesty and open dialogue is key to HEAR's work, so it's always nice to see an organization put its money where its mouth is. Thank you both so much, Ed and Marta, for joining me. And until next time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Val.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Hear Hear, the Humanitarian Podcast. This podcast is available on Spotify or YouTube. To find out more about our work, please visit hear-geneva.org, follow us on Twitter or LinkedIn at Hear Geneva, or subscribe to our YouTube channel.